For those of you who don't know where South Shields is, it's on either side, well, South Shields on one side and North Shields on the other side of the entrance to the Tyne, just off the North Sea. In fact, these gentlemen represent both sides of the Shields community, one from the north and one from the south. Both have been involved in this case for some time and have written up the book, which can be recommended to you. It's a terrifying case. I'm not going to say much more than that because I don't want to take away from the speakers. But to introduce Mike, a paranormal investigator, 40 years of research in the field, and an author, and I think a member of the SPR.
That's Durham.
Our sister organisation down in London. I like to call it our branch, but it is a bit cheeky. Darren here is also an author and civil servant and a member of the SPR since 2006. And he's had an interest in the paranormal ever since. He'd had strange experiences as a child. And I can relate to that. I'm not going to say any more except words of appreciation when they've finished. I'm looking forward to the talk, as I'm sure are you. Show it, please, in your applause. And turn off your mobile.
Right, well, I'd just like to say thank you there for that very kind introduction. As you know, we're from Newcastle, well, I'm from Newcastle upon Tyne. And I've been told if by any chance I start talking too fast or if anyone can't actually understand what I'm saying, just put your hands up and ask us to repeat what I've just said, because sometimes I get carried away and all of a sudden, you know how it is. I've got a very strong Geordie accent, but I'm trying to tone it down for Trish. Just to listen to. Right, basically, many paranormal investigators and researchers dream of the ultimate case, the poltergeist from hell, where they are given an opportunity to study and examine the form, and I quote Guideline Playfair here, on one of the most bewildering phenomena we are ever likely to come across. In the beginning of summer 2006, that dream became a reality for Mick Hallowell and I when I was approached by a colleague at work who informed me her friend's daughter had a ghost. After making contact with this, with the mother of one of the principal experienced, I was able to determine she was indeed frightened and something, this was indeed something which could have warranted an investigation. Over the space of the next few months or so, I kept in touch with the family and offered what advice I could whenever they phoned up to see what had been happening at this house. I asked the homeowner if she could keep a log of what happened, daily of events as such, basically like saying when it happened, noting down what occurrence it was, who witnessed it, etc., which she agreed to do so, and continued to do so until the case actually came to a close some 7 or 8 months or so later. One day in July 2006, I got a telephone call from the homeowner, and she was very, very distraught. Apparently, this ghost, or whatever it was that she called it, had been causing havoc in her home. Objects were being thrown around, doors were being opened and slammed closed, all by themselves. Thumps and bangs and raps were reverberating around the house. Taps were being turned on, the possessions were disappearing, reappearing, and a young child, who she lived with, began to see people in the house. It was quite obvious by now that she was indeed terrified, and with the advice that I'd previously given her, she had basically come to a point where she could tolerate this thing no more. She now wanted myself to go over the house and see what was going on. I agreed to do so, and we made the arrangements for the first trip. In the meantime, I asked her to bear with it, be brave, keep taking the notes, and she agreed to do that. Now this is where my good friend Mike Hallowell comes in. Mike is an authority on the paranormal in the northeast of England, and he's been investigating and writing about the subject for over 40 years. There was really nobody else to ask, if I have to be brutally honest, So I picked up the phone and I phoned Mike, and I explained a little bit to him about what was going on. Basically, my thoughts were, if this was indeed a genuine case, which I know sort of dealt in my mind that it could have been, it might actually be a live poltergeist at work, which was rather exciting. I asked Mike if he would assist me with the case, and he agreed to accompany me to the house on the first visit. A few days went by, and the visit came along. On our way to the house, we discussed the case, and I told Mike about what had been happening subsequently since I first called Mike. I also briefed him on what had been going on in the house since the strange happenings had sort of begun, which was about 6 months prior to that. We both agreed that it sounded too good to be true. As in a lot of cases, investigators turn up at houses where people report funny goings on, ghosts, etc., and a lot of the time you never experience anything, or it can sometimes be explained away with various means. We both agreed it would be nice to witness something nice for ourselves and verify that there could be something indeed going on. But in all honesty, we thought the chances were relatively low, to be honest. If anything, they say we expected nothing to happen. Little did we know that what was waiting for us at this house in question would essentially basically change the way we think about the poltergeist phenomenon, and it would change the way we thought about poltergeists forever. It was also a day that we would never forget. On that particular first day, we arrived at the house and introduced ourselves. We had a cup of tea and a friendly chat with Marianne and Mark, who are the homeowners on this particular house. At this point, I'd just like to verify that Marianne and Mark are in actual fact pseudonyms for them. They actually wish to remain anonymous and still do to this day. So they're the names we give them. And basically, we had a bit of a chat and we become acquainted with them. We got to know them a bit. We began to thoroughly interview them and find out what exactly had been going on in this normal-looking two-up, two-down terrace house. Equipment was set up, video cameras, EVP machines, dictation machines, tape recorders, etc., all over the house and in the rooms, and then we spent some time just talking to the couple, trying to reassure them in what way we could. All the while, hoping deep down that something odd might occur and we could experience it for ourselves. It wasn't until about 4 hours into the first visit on that being and hot 2006 afternoon, we were astounded to see what we would later term as the South Shields poltergeist at work. I've got a list here of a number of things that occurred on that day. The plastic nut flew across from an empty part of the room and hit Marianne via the cupboard door. Basically, this little yellow plastic nut which was sitting in the corner, obviously we had no idea that was going to stop being thrown around, somehow just took off and it bounced off the cupboard wall with such force it actually ricocheted off the cupboard door and it hit Marianne on the backside and she yelled in pain. Obviously she got a bit of a fright, she started getting worried. Both Meg and I got a little bit excited, we got a bit happy. Could this have been the first sort of experience? And we later determined it was. So when me and Meg got a bit excited, you can understand that we had to turn around to Marianne and Mark and say, look, sorry for being so happy about this, because obviously this thing's, you know, bringing you down and it's making you feel, you know, you believe that they were at the wit's end sort of thing. But at least then it verified to us that something strange potentially now could have been going on, as opposed to what we thought earlier. You know? Right, later on we heard creaking and knocking in the child's bedroom during a designated period of time up there. Again, we were sitting up there just waiting for stuff to happen. If anything was going to occur, we were hoping it was going to occur that day. And we heard all these strange noises, which we tried to find rational explanations for, but we couldn't. All the way, we were scratching our head, we were wondering how these, what these things that originated from. An interesting occurrence was when a rubber ball appeared from nowhere on the bed. Now, Mark and Marianne were sitting on the bed, and they were in full view of us. I mean, we were, as Meg will probably tell you later on, when we first went in, we were watching this family like a hawk. We were keeping our eyes on them at every moment we can, because a lot of the times, people just want to pull your leg. They want to play tricks on you. They want to wind you up. People enjoy winding people in and making them look foolish for whatever reasons, whatever the motives are. I have no idea. So the first thing we were thinking about was fraud. Is someone taking the mick? Or, you know, being funny beggars, you know? So we were watching these like a hawk, and I never noticed Mark or Marianne, and Mike never noticed Mark or Marianne, throw up a ball or even have a ball. All of a sudden this ball appeared on the bed out of nowhere, and the two of them jumped up, quick as you like, framed, saying the ball had appeared on the bed. So we picked up this ball, and it was actually rather quite hot, which was rather very interesting. Then another yellow nut flew off the chest of drawers across the room in a cardboard box. All the while, we're talking about one incident, then another one occurred, which obviously got me distracted, and I was like, whoa, what's going on here? Something else is occurring. Again, we were looking at this couple, we couldn't see any form of fraud at that point, yeah? And it was getting quite exciting, so to speak. Again, myself and Mike were overjoyed, because I say, at last, we've come to a house where something's actually happening. But again, in one breath, we're like, happy, hooray. In the other breath, we do apologise to you, but you have to understand, from our point of view, this is what we need to see. So we know that you're not telling us a pack of lies, or you're not making it up, or you're not misinterpreting anything that you may deem as paranormal. A tiny ball slid off the drawers and landed in a metal bin with a clash. Nobody was near it. The nightlight that had been plugged into the landing was found unplugged and then put on the landing floor. Other sound recordings of knocks, bumps, movements, pinging, thumps, shuffling of footsteps was all recorded. There was a sound that sounded like glass marbles moving on a wooden surface, guitar strings plugging, coins spinning, and a bloop, 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 and a weird coughing noise. That was all recorded on one length of tape. Now, as it happens, Dr. Barry Colvin from the SPR was doing some research. Later on, we found out he was doing this research, and we sent him a couple of snippets of the sound recording with some of the taps on and the bumps. Now, he subsequently come back to me and said that the sound recordings of the bands and the taps that we've recorded match all the other anomalous cases that he's been looking at. Unfortunately, the report that Barry wrote, which was in the Journal of the Society for Psychic Research, only goes up to the year 2000. I think it's from 1960 to the year 2000. And with our case being after 2000, it wasn't included, so we're hoping he's going to do a little bit more research and maybe include our recordings. But he did say there was a sound signature in the knocks that we sent him that match all the other interesting paranormal cases. So at last, you know, we had some good scientific evidence that what we recorded was genuine, which would go on top of everything else that we sort of saw and the other witness testimonies we've got. The aforementioned phenomena we discussed at length, and at first we were convinced it was genuine on first glances, you know, we looked, but we always had a bit of a slight nagging feeling there at the back of the mind that we might have been tricked or duped in some way. Fraud, we believe, has to be in the forefront of any investigator's mind in cases like these, and it was in ours. We believe that's the first thing you've got to look for, people taking the mic. But we saw and we heard these objects move, being moved around. You know, there was only the four of us at that time. These incidences that we saw, if that makes sense. We saw them with our own eyes. We were convinced quite early on in the investigation that it was a genuine case. We had our eyes transfixed on the couple, watching their every move, just in case something did occur. So, in effect, we were sort of ready for it. If we were going to catch them faking stuff, we figured we might catch them on the first day. As it happens, we never caught them faking anything on that day. And subsequently, for the rest of the investigation, we still never caught anybody actually either setting up anything, or we never caught anybody red-handed doing anything. And as you'll soon see, we experienced a heck of a lot more than, you know, what I've just mentioned here. This was to be the beginning of something special for us, and we then knew that we could have an active poltergeist in this house. Little did we know that within the coming months, what seemed like a friendly, playful ghost or a low-level poltergeist that would throw around toy cars and plastic nooks, etc., would turn against the family with a vengeance, and it would terrorise Mark and Marianne almost to the point of nervous breakdown. Over the next 7 months, we made many visits to the house and stayed over at the house many times, trying to help the family in what way we could, documenting everything that occurred there as much as we could. We believe we got literally just about every incident that occurred. When we weren't at the house, the couple were there keeping that diary and keeping us informed of what exactly was going on. The strength and the ability of this thing grew bigger every day, and its desire to frighten, terrorise and intimidate and feed it on the fear of this family, which by now had become almost physical wrecks. It was actually quite sad to see, to be honest. Just when this family in question, and Mike and I, thought it couldn't get any worse, it turned on Mark with such brutal force, we were left wondering just what the hell are we really dealing with here. For me personally, if I've got to be honest, we're dealing with the unknown, yeah, and I did get a little bit, not frightened as such, but I got a little bit nervous, which obviously I kept from the family because they were actually looking to us for the help, and I really didn't want to let the family know. I was like, oh my dear me, what the hell, you're like, ooh, I'm going to run and, and not come back. From the outset, Meg and I promised that we would stay with the family and help them through this, no matter how tough it became for them and for us. We would not cut and run. We would not desert them in the hour of need. We were there for the duration. We know that poltergeists eventually do come to an end. However they come to an end, we don't know. But they do burn themselves out eventually. There's always light at the end of a tunnel. If it was a haunting, maybe it would be there for years. The poltergeist, which is what we thought it was, we knew it would eventually come to an end. And we did reassure the family. We say, look, we don't know how long it's going to take. It could be tomorrow, it could be next week, could be 6 months down the line, but this will come to an end, and we will stay here with you and help you through this. But by now it was getting extremely violent, and we sort of got the impression that it wanted to cause physical harm in whatever way it could. By this point it had started throwing carving knives around at people, and had left messages from Meg and I on a message board to tell us to get out and stop it now. Obviously, get out is plain as day. It didn't want me there. Stop it now, we presume, is just pack the investigating in. Leave us alone. Meg and I, we're not going to go anywhere. The metaphorical gloves, so to speak, had come off, as cheesy as that sounds. Yeah, but we're there to stay. Number of reasons, again, primarily to help this family concerned. We knew that by now that this case was a good one, and we wanted to get as much as we could documented. For evidence, basically, for an evidential value. So staying we did, and this is what happened, right up until the poltergeist burnt itself right out. The thought crossed our minds, and we often wondered just how long this phenomenon would go on for. Sometimes we even thought it was just going to go on forever. And every time we reassured this family, it'll stop soon, don't worry, it'll stop soon. It just seemed to make more lies out of it, because it just kept on coming. And it just kept on coming. And Marianne used to say to us, I thought this was going to end. You said it was going to end. And we were saying, well, it will. But we said it from the start, we don't know exactly when. And we're not in control of this thing. Unfortunately for you, terribly fortunate for us, It turned out to be a long case. When we actually went in to start investigating, it had already been going on 6 months. We thought we were going to just get the tail end, but by then it was just warming up. After 12 months of hell for the family, and 7 or 8 months or so for Mike and I, the poltergeist faded away, but only for a month or so before it came back to wreak havoc for just one more week. This 1 week was the last week of torment for the family, and after this period, the poltergeist activity at the house ceased forever. A terrifying, brutally nasty and vicious encounter with the poltergeist had come to an end, and at last the family began to live a normal life once more. But I also kind of just say there, in the space of 10 minutes, I've summed up what went on for months. Again, Mike's going to do some more talking later. We've got a bit of a DVD with some of the evidence on, which we're going to show you. And there's a hefty, weighty tome that the book were penned about the entire affair. So obviously there's a heck of a lot more to it than just what we're saying now, you know? Since the Enfield case in 1977, 1978, or was it 78, 79? Since the Enfield case, there's been a number of poltergeist cases reported over the years. Cardiff, for example, is a good poltergeist case. And there's been many more. None of these cases were documented to the extent that the Enfield poltergeist was, nor did the last half as long. Yeah? Cases like Enfield are very rare indeed, and investigators such as the late Maurice Gross and Guy Playfair were very fortunate indeed to be able to have witnessed and document so much activity from the outset. After 30 years after the Enfield case, Meg and I feel we were also very fortunate to experience and document this fantastic poltergeist infestation, which, like Enfield, infested the home of a normal family for an abnormal amount of time. After all, they say the shelf life for a poltergeist is usually a few months. In this case, it certainly wasn't. The South Shields case was indeed a true, real infestation in which certain paranormal phenomena, or the typical pult symptoms, matched and correlated with many other classic pult cases, reinforcing the fact that it was indeed a poltergeist we had dealt with. I say real, as sometimes I find myself asking the question during the case, is this really happening? As it was happening, you know, a guy Playfair said in the introduction to our book, they're hard to believe. These things are so hard to believe when they're happening. And he's seen poltergeists happen, yet he still finds it hard to believe. And I can see exactly where he's coming from there, to be honest. We had a vast array of phenomena at South Shields that had been reported in other pult cases for centuries. Wraps and bangs thrown around with household objects, accompanying apparitions, the materialisation of coins, money, moving furniture, written messages. They were all left for the family and left for Meg and I, and lots more. Poltergeist contagion was also experienced as well, with small levels of pol activity at Mike's house, which we both witnessed. I'm not sure if you want to go on, if you want to mention that later, about your contagion. Is Tim getting the better of it?
You're right.
Thankfully, though, nothing happened at my house. We even experienced a new phenomenon, or what we consider to be a new phenomenon from the poltergeist, as it sent death threats and imitating messages via mobile phones. Even when the SIM cards and the batteries were removed from them, we had actually taken the cards and the batteries out of this phone, yet this phone kept on sending messages to the lady of the house, basically telling her, if you pardon me language, tonight is the night you die, you effing bitch. Words to that effect. It was Vale. And obviously it terrified her. Whatever the poltergeist is, it seems it can move with the times and adopt it using modern technology. In the old days, it just used to throw around mud. When people lived in mud huts, they used to get pelted with bricks and stones. Now we've got computers and mobile phones. It can seem to adapt to them. It can send messages via computer. It can send, as we found out here, it can send you text messages. And that was the point where I started leaving my mobile phone at home as well, in case I started getting any messages, to be honest. I think it's a combination of good work, good fortune, sorry, hard work and commitment that we were able to document such a poltergeist case, such as this, and get the vast majority of strange occurrences documented from the outset. just about everything that occurred in that house for 12 months when the pug was at work has been documented. That alongside extraordinary video footage that we ascertained of the poltergeist as it attacked one of the householders, which is very interesting. This footage will be shown later on tonight, so make of that what you will. We have hundreds of still photographs of displaced objects where they've been moved to. A lot of the time, obviously, it's hard to know where something's going to move and when it's going to move from. You point the camera in that direction, something over here moves. You point the camera over here, somewhere over this side moves. So the best we could do was document it the best we could. So whenever something was moved, we photographed it in situ. And we've got hundreds of those photos. We have got AVP and dictation device recordings, which include anomalous voices, footfalls, shuffling his feet, etc. And hours and hours and hours of videotape footage on what files at home. This combined with 17 different independent witnesses, 22 if you include the family in question, and me and I, that have supplied same statements testifying to what they saw in this house. It would have been more, but there was a number of neighbours who refused to actually get involved altogether. We asked them for statements, they saw stuff there, they refused to. I guess they were just too framed. If they wrote anything down, they thought then they might get attacked by this thing or whatever. So that's what we've got. Both me and I feel that this is one of the best documented cases of poltergeist since Enfield. And like the Enfield case, it's been written up fully, and the entire story is in the book of the South Shields Poltergeist, and that was published in 2008. We hope, like Enfield, our case and our book will be remembered for what it is, and that's a terrible, vicious attack on an innocent family of an entity that we know nothing about, which is known as the poltergeist. And that's basically it for me. That's like an introduction and an overview of the case and stuff like that. And now I'm going to hand over to Mike. And we're going to ready for the DVD first.
I think we'll best go straight into the DVD.
Go straight into the DVD.
And I'll cut
swap
it
over.
Yeah.
Okay. So I hope you like what you see. Thank you very much.
Is it me?
Mike, what is it we're going to see in the DVD then, the first part?
Right, I'll just sort this out and then I'll... Yep. Right. Just looking for, okay.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, first of all, personal thanks from me as well for the invite to come and talk. And I also owe a debt of gratitude to Darren for bringing me in on this case, because he very kindly sort of plunged me in the middle of an absolute nightmare which lasted for months, and if it hadn't been for him, I would never have had to go through all that. The South Shields case actually changed my own perception of everything concerning paranormal phenomena in a lot of ways, radically changed my perception of things. We made a DVD, right, which was very hastily put together. And I'll apologise beforehand, all right, because it's not... what is the footage that you're going to see, some of it is not particularly brilliant quality, but that's to do with the circumstances under which it was taken, right? And I may pause the DVD at places to explain to you little bits of things that were going on at the time. It's certainly not a Steven Spielberg production by any standards, so I have to tell you that. The DVD is really a potpourri of bits of audio and video recordings that we took at South Shields. And we put it together really just to give you a sort of a flavour of the type of thing. And one of the things I have to apologise for as well is that we had to blot out the real names of the experience. And not having any experience at all of editing, sort of like doing any sort of digital editing with footage, we introduced a series of bleeps over the top of the names, right? And we, for some reason, these are about three times as loud as the actual audio, right? When we give this lecture at the SPR down in London, right, I think we've got three ambulances full of people who got taken away with suspected cardiac arrests, right? So just, I'm preparing you now, all right? We'll play the DVD, let's see, it's just, it's a mishmash of stuff, but it does give you a general flavour. Looking back now, it does look a bit cheesy, to use Darren's phrase, right? And it's not very well put together, certainly not a sophisticated presentation, but we do think it does the job in it, you know. We will be making a better one at some point.
You just want to mention the faces are on it from his brain.
Yeah, you will actually see the faces of the individuals concerned, although their names are blotted out, right? We do have an understanding, we don't, but I'll re-emphasise this, right? We have had an absolute nightmare with copies, pirated copies of our footage being distributed over YouTube and on the internet, right? So, unfortunately, it's sad, but we've had to make a very strict rule that absolutely no sound or visual recordings, other than the ones that we've given the society to make, are actually made. So please don't take any photographs with mobile phones or anything else, or any sound recordings, because we've had real problems in the past with this. But never mind, we'll play this, and I may, as I say, pause it from time to time just to give you a little commentary on what's going on there.
Yeah, that was cheesy.
Where are they? Okay, I just want to pause that there. As you can see, that's a bottle. And it's not doing what bottles normally do, standing correctly on its base. It's balanced on its edge. This piece of footage is one of the most notorious that was filmed during the whole South Shields poltergeist affair. And it's one for which we were subjected to a notorious amount of criticism, and it was entirely unjust. Let me explain to you why the circumstances. One evening, it was just before midnight actually, my wife had just went to bed, and I received a phone call from the lady in the house, and she was extremely distressed, and she said that it started off again, and it was doing all these terrible things. It was throwing knives around and coins and making terrifying noises over the baby monitor, as if there was someone in the child's room, and when they went up there was nothing there. Then we'd come back downstairs and they would find a dining chair in the middle of the floor, And it was just getting worse and worse. So they asked, would I please come over? And I said, okay. So I very hastily put together, threw a camera in a bag, stills camera, which had a video clip facility, and a notebook and a pen, and I think that was about it. Basically, just dashed out of the house and went straight over. Now, there was quite some extraordinary things happened during that night, which you'll see on the presentation in a moment. But at the end of the night, the family were completely exhausted, and there was one room in the house, the living room, that was relatively free of this thing's activity, right? Not completely free by any means, but relatively free. So the entire family decamped in the living room. And between the living room and the kitchen, there was this large glass door, okay? And I said, look, I'll sit up, you try and get some sleep, because they both had work the next day. I said, if anything happens, I'll let you know. And there was a series of rather odd things happened. There was a smell of burning, and there was a sort of smoky sort of atmosphere at one point filled the kitchen area. The kitchen come down it. And then this bottle of mineral water that I had in front of me did this, right? I didn't actually see it tip onto its edge like that, but I looked and there it was. And you'll see in the footage, okay, just what happens. I'll let you see this, and then I'll tell you something else extremely interesting about this. I'm actually filming this with my stills camera, the video clip facility on it. You'll actually see the bottle wobbles as I'm knocking the table with my legs. That wasn't intentional. That heavy breathing is me, by the way, not the poltergeist. I'll actually physically push the bottle over here at this point. Now, the problem was that I was the only one who saw this, and I filmed it. So you can imagine, right, the skeptics had an absolute field day with me, and I was accused of faking this footage, right? Just about anyone who recorded anything was accused of faking stuff at some point, right? But I really got it in the neck for that bit of footage. And I honestly had resolved, or sort of more or less just accepted that this was going to be something I was going to have to stick with. You know, that I was always going to be, I had no proof that I hadn't faked it. In fact, there were some people who actually recreated this little vignette and posted their efforts up on the internet. And we know who they are. One of them, I think, doesn't realise that we know who they are. Still says extraordinarily nice things when he meets us. And I think possibly he doesn't even realise that we're aware of who actually did this. But never mind. We really got some horrendous criticism. Well, let me just fill you in on something. The accusation that was made, basically, was that we had faked this to sort of shore up the evidence, if you like, of the case. And that we were presenting this as one of the most extraordinary bits of the case. It was, look, it hasn't just done all the other stuff, but no, it's done this. Well, the truth of the matter is, anyone who reads the book, right, will see that in the account, I actually offer my comments on this piece of video, and I actually say in the book that its evidential value is virtually useless. So I fail to see why we would go to extraordinary lengths to create a piece of footage like this and then tell everyone that it was absolutely no good as evidence, right? It's sort of like it's defeating the purpose of the exercise. But then something truly extraordinary happened, and I'm not sure whether we've actually ever mentioned this before in a lecture, but after the socialist case had sort of like died out, but before, and this is crucial, before our book was published, Dan and I were asked to investigate another case a good few miles away. And we went to this particular place, which is going to be detailed in a forthcoming book that we're writing, which we've written actually, hopefully will be out before too long. And we asked the four or five residents, students, in this flat, okay, what sort of stuff's been happening? And four of the students were basically saying as well, there's all these weird things happening, they'd seen very sort of bizarre things happening in this flat. And we said, what about the fifth one? And they said, well, gee, we hasn't seen very much at all, you know, it tested us. She hasn't really seen anything. And we asked this person, so you said anything? She said, no, not really. And then she said, oh, just one thing. She said, probably going to think this sounds crazy, right? But she said, I came into my bedroom one day and I had a bottle of mineral water stand on my bed and said, come in. And she's never going to believe this. And I had a funny feeling, I thought, I bet you do. And it was standing on its edge, she said, right? It's spinning, it was like a weevil. And she said, it was just balanced there, right? Crazy. But I know what I saw. She says, you see, told you wouldn't believe it. I said, well, actually, we do, because we've seen it before. Just last week, I had a phone call from a colleague of mine, and I don't think he would mind me saying this, right, is very, very much towards the sceptical side, although he is a paranormal investigator. And he said to me, something really weird just happened. He said, I was in the bath. He said there was a shampoo bottle on the side of the bath. And he said it just tipped, it was bounced on its edge, just like that thing in South Shields. So this sort of heartened me, because I realised that what I filmed at South Shields, I wasn't the only person who had seen this very peculiar, very specific symptom of poltergeistry, right? Why it does this, I haven't a clue, right? I just know that I videoed it, you know? So, that was that. And there's some more footage later, which is a little bit more gruesome, but never mind. Here we see some of the doodle board messages that were left. A quick intro into what you're about to see here. Earlier in the night, before the bottle balance footage was taken, there was a series of extraordinary things happened. We would go into a bedroom. I mean, I'll give you one example, and you'll see a little snippet of this. We went into the master bedroom, and everything was fine. And then we heard a noise come from the child's bedroom next door, immediately adjacent. So we left the master bedroom and went into the child's bedroom, and everything sort of seemed okay. And then we heard another ban from the master bedroom, so we went back in there again. This took maybe, I can't remember, I think we were recording at the time, and I did put the time in the book. I can't remember what it was, but it was only maybe a minute less. And when we went back into the master bedroom, it was completely trashed. Right? Now, we heard nothing, absolutely nothing, right? Other than this one little faint boom, which drew us back into the... Then we went into the child's room, and there was a plastic table had been melted, which then miraculously restored itself, right? Now, there may be people out there who are sitting thinking, yeah, of course, sure, absolutely, I believe it, right? Well, all I can tell you is that Alan Murdy came up from the Society for Psychic Research and did an investigation of the case. And Alan actually said to Darren and I, his words were, after looking at the evidence, and bear in mind that during this time, right up to this point when Alan came up, we were being harassed, right, and on occasions even had to threaten police action, right, because of the amount of harassment that we were getting from people. The primary reason is that there was a lot of people out there who said that we either didn't have any evidence at all, or any footage, or anything, right, we'd made the entire thing up. And the reason that we weren't releasing the footage was because we really never had any. And the second thing they said was that we were actually holding on to the footage and not distributing all the evidence that we'd accumulated to make money. Well, if there's anybody out there that can tell me how you can make money by not actually selling anything and hiding it away in your cupboard, I'd love to know, because I don't know how that works, right? But anyway, then people were saying, we know of at least one person who asked another colleague of ours if she would surreptitiously, illegally obtain a copy of some of the footage. Fortunately, we found out what was going on in that, so that didn't materialise. We got threatening correspondence, basically saying that we had a moral duty to give all of this stuff out publicly in the public domain. And if we didn't, then they would find some way, over hell or high water, that they would do it. You know, we had this from a number of different sources. Our argument was, quite simply this, that one, we planned to do a documentary about the Celsius Poltergeist, and also we had other sort of projects in mind, and so we wanted to retain, obviously, control of the footage, because you know what I say, once you get something on the internet, and you lost it completely, it just goes. And we had a real battle to do this. And then, unfortunately, we... All this time when we were being accused of not really having any evidence or having it and hanging on to it and fake and stuff and all the rest of it, what people didn't realise, or our critics didn't realise, was that we had entered into negotiations with the Society for Psychic Research, and we basically said to them, look, you can have it all. It wasn't that we didn't want the evidence examined, we wanted it examined competently. That was all. Right? And we just weren't going to start tossing this out to every Tom, Dick and Harry who demanded, and they did demand, copies of everything that we had. We said, no, sorry, we'll give it to the people who we think do the best job of analysing this and, you know, researching this case. So anyway, Alan Murdy came up, and he looked at all the footage, and particularly he was interested, intrigued at one point about this table that had melted and then restored itself. And of course, as anybody knows, when you take digital photographs or audio or video, there is information encoded in there regarding the time that it was taken and so on. This was all looked at, and we established that the table was fine 1 minute, all twisted and mangled the next, and then miraculously restored again, right? We know we didn't say this, right? It just happened. So, Alan, who was very supportive towards us, he basically looked at all the evidence, and I mean, I think at one point he sort of made a criticism. Basically, what he said was, if anything, we sort of undersold the case because we had lots of material that we didn't give out or let people see, which was supportive of the case that we could have done. And he turned to Dan and I and he says, well, look, he said, it's either true or it's, and his very words were, he said, it's a hoax on a scale of the Hitler diaries, you know, and we know that it's true. So we were quite happy. We said, look, you can have a look. And he actually sat down and said, you can sit at the PC, right? He told him, we're on the crypto, you take it all the way, anything you want with it, you know. There's no caveats here. You can have what you want. And so we were quite confident, and of course, did that shut our critics up? No. They just found other reasons to sort of to get at us. Anyway, this footage is the Cuz footage, where earlier in the night we'd gone into the room and the guy in the house said that he felt a burning sensation. And I said, take your top up, you know, so he lifted his top up. And at first, all he could see was a teeny little red spot at the bottom of his spine, minute, just a little red mark, almost invisible. Now this footage is very grainy right at the beginning, but I can promise you, as it gets right towards the end, and I sort of pull back with this camera a little bit, you'll get an idea of what we were actually witnessing here.
Watch out for the boots.
He has back to this case, confirmed sensors on his back, and this red wheel marks appear on the bottom of his spine.
Just see that little red vertical line there?
Yeah. And the centre of the red mark. And it's actually becoming more pronounced now under the middle scratch appearing.
The lighting conditions were quite poor, unfortunately.
Okay, and a small blood spot will appear in the centre.
His cuts just suddenly appeared spontaneously on his back. Watch particularly the right hand side of his torso.
Of course, now it's going down and colour.
Sorry about this, but there are bits of this we'll have to tell you about.
It might have been just because we were walk across the scratches on the left hand face of the torso are now getting the red out and more pronounced.
Right, so tonight, for the very first time, Darren and I, nobody else has ever heard this, ever, we're going to tell you how we faked that footage. Oh, Darren.
Right here, mate.
Basically, well, actually, we didn't fake it. This is what a lot of people thought we'd done, right? And I must admit, it's brilliant. The idea was, right, this guy had a gluten allergy. So what we did was, we waited till everybody's back was turned, right, all the other 12 people who were in the room, and we seized the moment. I kid you not. We rubbed them all over with a slice of bread. And somehow, it caused these cuts to appear on his body. It was a gluten allergy, right? That's how we did it, right? Allegedly, right? I can assure you, if there's anybody out there daft enough to believe that, right, I promise you, we didn't do it, right? No gluten allergy. That's what we did here.
Can you just actually specify that that's what actually somebody said?
Yeah. That was actually said to us on more than one occasion. This is what could have happened, right? One person, to be fair, didn't actually accuse us of doing this. The suggestion was that someone else may have done it in hopes and fooled us, right? I can assure you, right, when you're in a small box bedroom with 12 paranormal investigators, right, the idea that you can stand there, right, and sort of like massage your torso with a, you know, slice of hovers or whatever, do you know what I mean? It just doesn't work for me, sorry. So, what I'd like to do is, you want to just tell you some of the rather shocking things that happened that I witnessed, all right? Because there were some. There was one occasion when we went into the bedroom, we heard a noise upstairs, and I went up with the couple. And you can actually hear, right, the terror in her voice. It's horrendous, you know? I went into the bedroom first, and they wouldn't come in. They were terrified. They didn't know what was going to confront them. And I went to the bedroom. I said, "It's okay, you can come in." And I said, "I have to ask you." I said, "Was the bed in the middle of the floor?" And she said, "No." And her voice was trembling. And I said, "Well, it is now, right?" And you can just hear her voice. She's on the verge of breaking down. And then there was pools of urine on the bedroom carpet would appear. On one occasion, it was Monday afternoon, phone call, "Can you come over? Terrible things are happening." We got to the house, and I went up the garden path, and I was joined by the man in the house, and she came running hysterically out of the patio doors that led into the back garden, and she just shouted, "Mate, it's trying to kill me. You know, it's trying to kill us now." And I told him to stay in the garden, and I went in, and a knife flew over my shoulder from the kitchen. I don't think for some reason it was meant to hit me. You know, I think if it had meant to hit me, it could have. I'm not a great believer now in this idea that poltergeists can't really harm you, they can only like frighten you. I used to believe that at one time, I don't know. Anyway, this knife flew on my shoulder and ricocheted off this TV stand that was mounted on the wall. I certainly wasn't the only investigator to witness things like that. That was just my experience. They left the house. I was on the telephone to the CR2S. "Says, when you get your mum, just give me a ring, let me know that you're okay." She was on the phone, and this thing kept sending her text messages when we were talking. Telling what I was going to do to her, right? Absolutely traumatising, this woman. Absolutely horrendous. It scratched in big letters in the bedroom wall, RIP, right? Which obviously has very, very gruesome connotations, particularly as it was scratched in the bedroom. It was a child's bedroom where this was scratched. Now this thing, right, I want to tell you something that probably sounds rather funny, right? But in the grand context of things, it isn't funny at all. Right? It really isn't. Now, I wanted to tell you something, which Darren and I had a disagreement at the beginning of this case, right? It turned out Darren was right, okay, and I got it wrong. Let me tell you what it was. Before I got involved with the South Shields poltergeist case, the book, I've had about a dozen books published, but the one before the South Shields poltergeist, I wrote a book called Invisikids, which was published by the Heart of Albion Press. And basically, it was an in-depth look at the whole phenomenon of invisible childhood friends, or imaginary childhood friends, right? I got commissioned to write a couple of articles by a magazine in the States about this, and I got so many stories sent to me, I thought, oh, I sort of smell a book coming on here, you know? Wrote this book, and I was fascinated, obviously. I was still on a bit of a high when the book came out, and I had this fascination with the subject. And we went into the house, and everything that I saw in the house, or pretty much everything, was leading me to believe that what may have been working, because one of the theories I came up with in the book was that so-called imaginary childhood friends are not really imaginary at all, but actually have some form of objective existence. So I saw things, for instance, you know, Darren mentioned the little yellow nut that flew across the room. It seemed to come from a height of maybe, I don't know, 18 inches, 2 foot off the ground, as if a child had thrown it. And I was getting these little signals that the whole thing seemed very childlike. In some of the messages it left on the doodle boards, it would address the woman in the house as Mum, which is a Geordie colloquialism for mother. And I said to Dan, you know, I said, I've got a weird feeling this could actually be a quasi-corporeal companion, as I termed them, right, which is a more accurate, a bit of a mouthful, but it's a more accurate phrase than imaginary child of friends, because I came to the conclusion they're not imaginary, right, they're not always children and they're not always friendly. And Dan said, I don't know, and he sort of went for the simple thing, which is the poltergeist, and I said, look, I think there's some poltergeistry going on here. But I said, I think there's something else. And this thing was just sending me messages, right? Little tidbits that was real me. And it did a really good job. Because it got me, I think it knew that I had an interest in this subject. I'd just written a book about it, and it saw me coming, basically. And it presented itself to me in a way that it knew I would be fascinated by, and I just fell for it. And Darren was the one who sort of issued a bit of word of caution and said, I don't know, I'm not sure. And then there was a particularly nasty message on this doodle board thing, where it started off childlike and ended very, very nasty indeed. And we realised this was the same entity, basically. It was just yapping their chin. That's all it was doing. So, I realised then how devious these things can be. I'd always classed myself as an experienced researcher, not one to be easily taken in. It took me an end. But you see, what it did, and I think Dan would back me up on this one, right? That was chilling enough, the fact that this thing could manipulate you and get you to think things that weren't correct, and it could confuse you and lead you down blind alleys. But it got worse than that, because this thing was a master, an absolute master of taming. I've got to be honest and give credit where it's due. This thing tamed what it did to absolute perfection for the maximum, most devastating effect. And it knew how to do it very, very well indeed. Let me give you one example. Darren mentioned the incident where we disassembled all the mobile phones. Okay? Now, this thing, right, left a message. I'm just going to actually shut this video down for a minute, okay? Just bear with me. Okay, this is a message that it left, okay, on the landline, I believe. This was a mobile phone. And it's not threatening and it's not intimidating. It just says one thing over and over again. It's an automated message. Basically just hi. Okay. It's not nice to get mystery messages like that, but it certainly wasn't violent or threatening. And then it sent a text message to this lady, and it said, I'm sorry, I'm going now. And she so much wanted to believe that this thing was going to exit her life and the lives of her family members, she believed it. The reason she believed it was because she wanted to believe it so much. She convinced herself and she said, look, maybe it is, maybe it's sorry. Maybe it's got a conscience. Maybe it's really sorry for everything it's done, and I really think it is going now, I really do. And we said, whoa, I'm text. Look, you know, this thing is it's lied, it cheats, you can't believe anything it says. But she just so much wanted to believe that this thing was really sorry and was really going. And within a space of a few minutes, she'd really convinced herself, despite our words of caution, that it was going. Because she wanted to believe it. Then the phone rang. Listen to this. It only had 2 words to say to her.
I'm back. Okay? I'm sorry.
Play it again, mate.
I'm going. And she convinces herself she's going. And then, just when she's feeling that sense of relief, I'm back. Right? I'm going. No, I'm back. Right?
This thing was a sadist. It really was. We tried every trick in the book, to be honest with you, to get rid of this. We managed to make inroads in certain ways. The big breakthrough from my perspective was when we brought a colleague in, Stephen Swales, who was a senior lecturer at Sunderland University. And it was on the back of, again, a very funny incident, actually, the one I was going to mention here briefly. And that was that anybody who knows the northern region knows there's a massive football divide between those who live at the south of the Weir and those who live on the north side, right? Those who live on the north side are colloquially known as Geordies, and those who live on the south side are colloquially known as Mackhams, right? And if you're a Mackham, you'll support Sunderland, and if you're a Geordie, you'll support Newcastle. It's as simple as that. Now, this family were right in the heart of Geordieland, and the young lad had on his bedroom door a poster of Newcastle's icon at the time, Alan Shearer, right? Greatest centre-forward in his probably ever known, on his door. Well, you wouldn't agree to a Sunderland supporter, but then I think. Anyway, this thing ripped the hair off this poster. It decapitated this football icon. And it was actually quite strange, because I can remember the bizarre reaction from the lad in the house. He said, you know what I mean? He said, it's done some stuff, but that is just the lowest of the low, right? That's what he actually said. It was reaction. It was quite funny at the time. And that made it all the more chilling, actually. Because this thing, right, would do things that almost have a humorous sort of perspective to them, right? What did we do? We brought Stephen in. Stephen figured there was a connection between mobile phone energy, radiation, electricity, and the strength of this thing. And he asked us a number of pertinent questions. He said, have they installed any electrical equipment recently? Yes, they have. Loads, right? Does it ever take mobile phones and take them from downstairs to upstairs? Yes, it does all the time. Are there any phone masts near the building? Yes, there are, right? And I was on the verge of saying, like, how do you know this old wise one, right? He said, you know, he knew it had nothing. Basically, had a theory these things can feed on this sort of energy. So we basically switched everything off electrical in the night other than the freezer, and it had a massive effect. This rather scientific approach, and so eventually it sort of petered away. It did come back, it manifested itself at their workplace, which is something I think we did in my next book. And so that was it, really, a really horrendous, scary adventure. I would just say one thing before I throw it open for questions, if that's okay. There's a little bit which I'm going to show you now, right? I just want to show you this and then just sort of make a concluding comment. Okay. This is just a series of vignettes of the sort of thing this thing would do to intimidate. It would move, it went through phases where it would focus on candles, it would focus on money, it would focus on knives.
Fish,
yeah, it went through a fish phase, everything would have a fish motif to it. Toys, you can see there, these horrible little vignettes it would create. These are little snapshots from this family's life for about a year. My wife actually had a bunch of nails thrown at her that time, down the stairs at her,
and she had called me to the house one time. There was nobody up there. It smashed a child's money box. Well, this was interesting. This happened to me, watch. Watch what happens when I open the cupboard. Whoa, bam. That was the doodle boards, right, which had actually been on the floor. Listen to this. Get some idea what the family went through.
Top of the stairs, and he had to talk himself. It's just on the ceiling that you right, was the bed in the middle of the floor, where it is now.
There you can see the bath panel. It kept dislodging a bath panel in the bathroom.
All of it, you want to you want, you're not a very happy chubby.
Listen very carefully to this.
Why?
Very carefully.
So, why don't you have a woman now?
It's very faint but distinct. It does answer me.
So why don't you do anything now? Five pence coin. The birds of the tear, 5 pence coin on the floor, and they picked it up, put it on the chest of drawers.
Stop there. There's nothing of very much consequence after that. Basically, that was the one and only time when it manifested itself physically in front of the experienced investigator. We saw it. The people tell you what it looked like, and the only way I can describe it is it looked like a three-dimensional silhouette, like a man in a black body stocking from the top of his head to the base of his feet. And it just paused momentarily. You heard her reaction when she saw it. Jump, whoa, you know, and then he just walked into the bathroom and disappeared, right? Couldn't make himself, she was a poltergeist. Fortunately, not long after that, it eventually did peter out. That's the case. The only thing to add before we throw it open is this. I was always very polite with skeptics, right? And I still am if I think they're genuine. But I must admit, right, I've hardened my attitude a lot to skeptics who just, without even considering the evidence, probably refuse to believe that anything really paranormal went on there. And the reason I do that is because, one, they weren't there, we were. We saw it, we collated the evidence, we saw what, with our own eyes what it did. But the most galling thing that I find when people decide I don't believe it, right, it was all misattribution. They just misunderstood everything. It was all as a rational explanation. I say, look, you're insulting that family. You're insulting us, actually, right? And that's fine. If you want to do that, that's okay. But it's an insult to all those witnesses that Darren mentioned before, and to us, and to this family, to just blindly say that nothing really paranormal happened. I'm sorry, but it did. And that's the strength of this case, and it's also the controversial aspect of this case, because in most cases, it can either be misattribution, it can be, you know, it can be real or it can be fake, or there's that middle ground where it's neither, it's just a genuine misunderstanding of natural phenomena. Not in this case. It's either real or it's fake. There's no middle ground, unfortunately. Right? It's either a hoax or it's genuine. And that puts us in a dilemma, but it puts the sceptics on an even bigger dilemma, because then they have to either point the finger and say, well, you faked it, and if that's the case, because I don't believe in that script. Okay? A very controversial case. Anybody got any questions?
Mike, could I just a couple of things? First of all, as an investigator, for as many years as you have, I've investigated poltergeist cases, so I'm not an amateur critic by any manner of means. Okay? Yeah. The next thing I'd like to say is this. When you first started talking about this case, true, I've seen this thing, sort of stuff happen myself because I've done it, I've been there, I've seen it. That's not a poltergeist. That's the first thing. It's more like an elemental, okay, or possibly something demonic. That's the next thing I'd like to say. Further on, towards the end of the presentation, you hit on something that I don't think you've been given enough of. And I'm going to ask you, have you ever heard of something called the Hutchison effect?
Yeah, okay.
Now, your mention of the person that asked you were there any radio transmitters, were there sources of electromagnetic radiation, all that kind of stuff. Okay. Now, a guy called Albert Budden went into this chapter and verse about electrical hypersensitivity. Yeah. I corresponded with Albert for a long time, fell out with him eventually, but it was easy for me to work. Mm-hmm. The point is this, that you've either, there is a middle ground here, there is a middle ground. Okay? It's not necessarily paranormal, but it's very, very unusual, and it starts to teeter into the paranormal area, and that is electrical hypersensitivity. Okay? So if it's not an elemental, which it might be, then you can certainly exhibit a lot of the stuff that's clearly elemental behavior, and also demonic behavior, because it's involved, I've seen this happen as well. So you've either got a case of an elemental in that house, or you've got a case, a prime case of electrical hypersensitivity being demonstrated by one of the people in that house. So that's your middle ground, I would say, is the possibility that involves electrical hypersensitivity at some point. It's just an observation.
Okay, thanks for that observation, Brian. Dorothy.
You made the wrong termination when you called it a thing.
Oh, dear.
Oh, indeed, you did. These things happen everywhere. Not as violent as this, but that energy had found the means in that particular house to operate where it maybe couldn't elsewhere. These are malevolent spirits that have not graduated. They've gone over with this intent. They've maybe being destructive in their ordinary life here on earth, and that continues. And like attracts like, always, in the here and in the hereafter. They found the means to be able to demonstrate the power there, to put the fear into somebody. I don't think you approach that in the right manner, actually, to get to find who it was, and you could have done. If you found who it was, you'd have had the case solved. That is my
answer. Well, can I just say that, to be honest with you, it's, if you don't mind me saying so, and I take your question, and it's very insightful, and there's some aspects of it I think you're actually quite near the mark, but I think maybe there's an assumption there when you say you could have found out who it was, right? That's working on the presumption that it is a who, right, or it is a person, do you know what I mean? And I'm not at all convinced that the poltergeist is a person at all, in the sense that we would understand it. Now, that's your interpretation, right? You're entitled to it. We have our own about what the poltergeist phenomenon is or represents. I also take the point about the elemental thing.
Yeah.
One conclusion I have come to, right, is that there is some sort of connection between the poltergeist phenomenon and the broader elemental thing. And that's something that will be coming out in another book. But I do agree with you to this extent. I believe there is definitely a connection there between the two now. Where one, and I thought the poltergeist was something in isolation, do you know what I mean? So I think you're correct there. You know, any thoughts?
Well, I really can't really say anything. I would agree what Mike just said, to be honest, and it's punished me actually saying anything, wasting any more time, because I agree with Mike, yeah. Yep. Definitely, yeah.
Got a question at the back?
Yeah, my question is to do with the ball that appeared from nowhere. Did the ball
Yes, it did. I think
the
orange ball. Yes. Yes, it was actually part of the child's toys.
Another question, Tom?
Yeah, just as a matter of interest, you without categorising and memorising the label and the anything, the experiential thing where the guy shows you these marks or lesions in his skin.
Yes.
It's not normal to get into a room with a guy and a guy pull up a shirt and take a picture of it. What was it prelude to that? The guy doing something happening that.
Right. Very good question. I'll explain to you what happened. When I arrived at the house after getting this phone call, okay, jumped in this taxi, got down there, they were sitting at the dining room table, okay, now when I went in, there was tea and coffee all over the table that being spilled, because this thing had sort of pushed the table and spilled some tea and coffee. They were sitting there, they were shaking, they were very upset, and there was a £10 note scrumpled up on the table. And what had happened was, before I got there, they said, we never took a penny off this family, right? There was implications and accusations made on the internet that we had sort of done this family over and got money out of them or used them to make money, all sorts. We never got a single penny. We spent an absolute fortune of our own on supporting this family and researching this case. Never took a penny off them under any circumstances, bar none. On the way down, the guy had said to his wife, I think we'd better offer him his taxi fare for coming down. And at that moment, a £10 note scrubbed up came and hit the table, right? That was the prelude to me getting there. After I got there, his wife said, he's got cuts all over his body. And I said, what happened? She said, well, he started to feel a sort of burning sensation. I told him to lift his shirt up, tried to have a look, and there was these cuts. Not quite as bad as what you saw on there. But when I got there, I photographed these cuts, and within the space of about an hour or whatever, they just disappeared, right? Or possibly with the exception of that very small red mark at the base of his spine. So I said, and what happened? He said, I don't know, my body just went hot. I felt burning, you know. She told me to lift the T-shirt up and there was these marks and then you got there photographing. So when we went upstairs, this was not a pattern exactly, but it had happened before. So when he said, I can feel that burning sensation again, it's happening again, straight away, my thought was, well, okay, the burning sensation was a precursor to the cuts downstairs. Maybe it's going to do this again. So I said, quick, take your shirt off. And I got my camera ready just in case, right? And sure enough, the cuts again followed the burning sensation. So that was how we. Does that answer your question?
So this sensation.
Yeah. I don't know whether I would go that far. I would say that I wouldn't say created. I would say there was a sequence, right? There was the burning sensation and then the cuts. I'm not sure what the interaction, you know, what the connection between the two exactly. I see where you're coming from. I'm not sure.
Okay. Young man, two rows in front of the top.
Yeah, that's quite sort of really interesting. I was just wondering, you know, given that in this situation it could be quite traumatic for a child, is there ever any discussion or is there a duty? Do you feel a duty of care maybe try and remove the child from the situation?
The child was actually removed from the house on a number of occasions. As this thing went on for so long, there was times where there was like sort of lulls in the activity. The child was then subsequently moved back into the house when it quieted down. When it kicked off again, the child again was removed out of the house. That was thought of. One interesting thing about this case actually as well is, although the child saw some of these figures, the child didn't experience any of the more harrowing stuff. The child experienced a few bad dreams. Wasn't bad dreams. The child experienced an apparition and seen things in the house. And at one point, the child sort of associated with another child who he called Sammy. But throughout of all of this, the child was actually was not fazed at all. The chap was a happy-go-lucky little chap, and he was bubbly, and he was a lovely little lad, still is. And this didn't faze him one bit. But in answer to your question, yes, when things got really bad, the child was removed out of the house for a precautionary measure.
I think it's also just after what that can I assure you and anybody else in the audience who might be wondering about this point, it's a perfectly valid question. That as two professional investigators, right, we pride ourselves on our professional approach to things. Had we for one moment thought that there was ever a time when that child was in the house and shouldn't be, or if we thought for one moment that the child should have been removed on a more or less permanent basis when it was over or whatever, those moves would have been taken. And I would also say to you that there are facts regarding this case which have not been released into the public domain that, if you were aware of, I think would assuage any concerns that you may have around this area, so...
Okay, we've got some questioners on the left.
This is a question for Darren. Obviously, both of you were very keen to avoid sort of imposing your expectations or American models on the experiencers. We don't want to suggest what was going on. What did the clients or the experiencers, what did the family think was going on? And Darren, you obviously seemed to be quite early on in the case, or 6 months into the case. Who else had the family seen or consulted?
The family, to be quite frank, hadn't a clue what was going on. The very first words when I found out about this case was, "My friend's daughter's got a ghost." She presumed that there was like some sort of ghostly presence in the house which was doing this. Sorry, what was the next bit?
No, just what they thought was going.
Yes, they did actually. They got a local priest in to investigate, and I do believe he carried out a ritual on the house, which after a number of weeks it fell quiet, and then it came back with a vengeance. They also had in a group of investigators, shall we say, from a spiritual group, and in all honesty, I've got to be quite frank here, by the time these people left, there was more ghosts in that house than what you'd get in a, there's a cat in the corner, yes, we've got a dog on the stairs, we've got a guy he's got a broken arm, he was in the army, we've got an RAF pilot upstairs. Don't get me wrong, I've got nothing against spiritualism as such, but there are certain people out there, there is certain groups who basically, if they were doctors, they'd be struck off. They should not be out there doing this, because when they went in and told her this, it sent her on a downward spiral, because she thought her house was literally full of spirit. She thought the land she was living on was possessed, even or whatever, and it had a horrible psychological effect. So yes, there was people that went in, and that's basically what happened. Is that to do with the African lady as well? You saw there was an African lady.
West Indian, West African. I think there's possibly been voodoo practiced in this house.
Right. Well, the only thing I can tell you is that there was only one person lived in that house before this family. It was an elderly lady who was... I think what you'd call your stereotypical white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, right? Who, as far as we were able to tell, had no heterodox sort of spiritual connections or unorthodox spiritual connections, anything like that. And the family themselves were determined our satisfaction. There was no hint or saying, one of the first things we asked them was, have you been doing anything sort of dodgy in a spiritual sense here, or have you been, we went into all of that side of things, we tried to find out whether they'd been engaging in any, not just voodoo, but any sort of unusual spiritual practices of any kind, you know, using the Ouija board and this sort of stuff. Went, you know, and there was just nothing. We just got a big blank zero. It was just.
I think, sorry, if I can just say it, there was a lecture I went to. It was in London at the SPR, and it was actually being carried out by Pete Underwood. And in the questions and answers, they got a bit of a discussion going about an apparition that was allegedly seen at a certain place. And at the time, this was not at the actual lecture, but at the time of the apparition was seen, they got into an argument, these people who were discussing it, and they were arguing whether this ghost had either green pants on or if it had red pants on. And they were discussing the nature of the ghost, whether it was Victorian, was he this, was he that. And Peter Underwood just stopped everybody and interjected and says, it doesn't matter if you've got red stuff, if you've got red pants on, if you've got green pants on, whether it's Victorian or whether it's not. The fact is, something paranormal occurred, and that's the most important thing. And I feel here in our case as well, there's a million and one ideas and theories about what's at the bottom of this. Our conclusion, as you've just seen, it's plain to see. Yes, we're going to get people who might beg to differ. Everyone's got their own opinions and ideas. And I think the fact of the matter is, something did occur. We're 100% to 100% convinced that something paranormal occurred. So at least in our eyes, we can say paranormality or strange occurrences like this certainly do exist, which is great, because nowadays you've got a lot of people who just deny the thing ever happened in the first place. After the case, which is now, the here and now, we're debating the case, we're throwing ideas around. I think that's absolutely fantastic. And it doesn't matter if we've went wrong, if we've got it wrong completely. Then another further edition of the book we might put some of the new ideas and theories in and bring it up to date after some of the talks and things that we've done. But I think the idea is, nobody's going to get anywhere unless these debates are being carried out, you know? So, yes, people can say we got it wrong. We'll hold our hands up and say, like, yes, you're entitled to your opinion. We're entitled to ours. Everybody throws ideas around. It gives you a platform for further discussion, future research. And I think, basically, this is what it's all about. The fact that something happened is besides the point. I think people now know that paranormal activity can and does happen.
Unfortunately, we're almost out of time, but Trish?
Did you get hurt yourselves at all? Were you injured?
No, I wasn't.
No, there were times when we did suffer from a little bit of contagion, right?
In what sense?
We would carry things home with us, right? It was very diluted. There's one occasion which we mentioned in the book, actually, where Darren and I were working, the wife was at work, and we're in our study, and we came and made a cup of tea and went to the kitchen where there's bark, and we went back and we studied, and the picture's actually in the book, you can see this, right? There's a huge tome called Hodgson's History of South Shields, a great reading thing, and it was just lying on the floor, right? Darren had experiences at his house, so we experienced things, and we did sort of get. We were targeted in a diluted sense, but we never actually suffered any sort of physical injury.
Can I just say, the experiences I had at my house were when we were compiling the new book. During the South Shields case, I don't believe very little happened at mine.
House. Well, there was a couple of things I recall.
Oh, no, tell a lie. I beg your pardon. Yes, there was, but I kept it from the other half.
Yeah.
That's why I never went. Because if she thought for 1 minute that I'd actually brought something home,
and
then I'd be out on my ear. It wasn't that long, I don't think, was it?
No.
It was after the guy moved in with him when it occurred. They'd recently taken out the mortgage. If anyone's got any concerns that they were trying to get rehoused, they had a mortgage. Mm. Also, if anyone's got any concerns they were in it for publicity, then they've rebuffed all publicity from the start. If anyone's concerned that it was all made up for attention, still to this day, almost 6 years on, nobody knows who they are. And nobody will.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I wonder if I could conclude matters just with a few words. First of all, Darren said this is about triggering a debate even years later. This is about throwing ideas out and respecting other people's points of view, but also making your own. And if you want some opportunity to do that and some robust but friendly debate, then come to Otto's Bar, which is just a little bit down Byers Road, because we continue the chat after the lecture. And I think you two gentlemen will be joining us in the bar for a little while.
Indeed, we will.
Good.
Oh, yes.
One of the very first things that was said tonight was that one of the things that excited their speakers was they turned up a case and something was happening. You may recollect a comment I made before when I said that when John Ployman took me with his wife Daphne out on my very first case, he said, "Do you think you're going to be investigating the paranormal in it?" And I said, "I hope so." And he said, "No. You're usually investigating other people's reports of the paranormal, past tense, because by the time you get there, it's gone." And I noticed right away at the very start of this talk, great, now I'm going to listen to somebody who opened the door and it was going on. And that got my attention right from the start. Second thing is, we're listening to a big case in which an awful lot went on through the filter of not just one, but two different people. And I think that really to get more detail and to get a lot of questions answered, because there were more hands up than I was able to take, you really have to buy the book. They've not plugged it particularly, but I'd like to announce to members that I intend to buy one copy of the book for our library. But of course, it's available. You've not brought any tonight, have you?
No. Unfortunately, the publisher at the minute hasn't got any.
Okay. That's good.
Yeah, they're in the process of making some new ones.
Okay, but we will get a copy for members.
You can get them online, yes, and you can get them in Waterstones and things.
Yeah.
But the publisher's demo, haven't got any, you know.
I noticed one thing that was said that I can relate to, and that is that when you're investigating cases, you will be subject to attack. And they've explained tonight some of the attacks that took place to the people involved. But of course, Mike in particular spoke about the quite dreadful attacks on their character and on their integrity and on their intentions and their motivation. And this is not, of course, restricted to paranormal investigators. Almost anyone who asserts paranormality will find themselves the subject of quite unfair and scathing character assassination sometimes, and certainly more than healthy, sceptical doubts and a look for the evidence. So there's an element to be admired here, because our speakers were prepared to stand up, even to talk about things that they knew themselves were of questionable evidential value, but they still wanted to put the message out there. And thank you tonight for sharing your experiences with us. What came across to me tonight is key test, a litmus test of paranormality is, does the experiencer feel changed? Do they feel that their views and their life has transformed in some significant way? And that's true for both of our speakers. It just emerged from the whole way that they've spoken tonight that they genuinely believe that they've experienced the paranormal, and they still don't understand it all. But thanks for taking us along a little bit of the journey of your understanding. And I'll finish with something that I do think is correct towards the end of your talk. There are some cases that are so strange and so weird that you are pushed into a polarised view. This is either genuine or it's a massive hoax. And I'm persuaded that it was not a massive hoax. But I am left with more questions than answers. And I hope that I'll get some answers in Otto's Bar. Make sure I'll be
here. Thank you.